The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to episode 5 of Courtside, the official podcast from the U.S. Open. I'm Nick McCarville, and I'm actually sitting just above Stadium 1 here in beautiful Indian Wells. This is the time of the season when tennis comes back to the U.S., and it's the BNP Paribas Open in Indian Wells, and also the Miami Open presented by Itaú. That is March tennis, professional tennis in the United States, and we've got a great episode coming up for you, myself and Steve Flink, with a couple interviews that I think you're really going to enjoy. First off, the legend Rod Laver. He talks about winning all four majors as an amateur in 1962 and then doing it again as a professional in 1969, 1 year after the start of what we all know now as open-air tennis. That's a sit-down with Rod Laver and Steve Flink. And then later in the episode, I got the chance to sit down with Tommy Haas. You will know him as a top five player. He reached world number 2, won 7 ATP titles in his career. He also reached some Grand Slam semifinals, been to a few quarterfinals at the US Open, but he's now the tournament director here in Indian Wells. We sit down with Tommy to talk about his tennis a little bit, but also about this tournament, his new role, and what the challenges have been for him in this new role. It's kind of a trend, right, on tour. We've seen a lot of players transition into the tournament director or some sort of tournament advisor role, and we got the distinct opportunity to sit down with Mr. Tommy Haas. But first, we get the chance to speak with the Rocket Man. It's Rocket Rod Laver. That's the interview with Steve Flink coming up here on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open.
Well, we're delighted to have Rod Laver with us here as we celebrate this 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open, of course, the first one held in 68. But Rod, your big year, of course, was the second year, 1969, because you were there to culminate. That was the completion of your second Grand Slam. And you did it in only the second year of open tennis. And of course, you could never have done it in 68 because the Australian Open hadn't gone open yet. So this was the first year that anybody could possibly pull this off in open tennis. So as you got to Forest Hills, and at that stage, you knew you were on the cusp of some of a really remarkable historical achievement, even more remarkable than 62. So let's go through the Open and some of the key moments. Dennis Ralston, 5-set match, 4th round, dangerous. What about that one?
Dennis was always a tough opponent of mine, and you know, he was able to read a lot of my shots, and you know, I do remember I was having trouble with my serve, and at 2-1 when we came off the 10 minutes, which we were allowed to do back in those years, Roy Emerson and Fred Stolle had been watching the match, and they came into the dressing room saying, you know, hey, you know, how's it going? And the only comment they had was, I said, you've got to throw the ball higher, so because everything is low, so everything's is coming into the net. I thought, you know, that's probably a good thing. That was something that was giving me trouble, and I went out there in the third set, fourth set, and fifth set, and I didn't have any problem at all. So then, you know, I was, you know, very appreciative of their comments, you know, whether I could have woken up and done that myself. But it was nice that you've got friends like Roy and Fred R to go into a match like that and then and be able to be helped along the way.
And then, of course, you know, Rod, then you had to deal with Roy. Roy had given you that nice advice, but then you had to come from behind to defeat him, and he was always a great rival of yours.
Yeah, he certainly was, and yeah, we were on an outside court, and of course, you have to remember we're playing on grass at this stage at the U.S. So you know the clay and grass courts were not the best, and so. You know, it was a close match, and I mean, you know, Emo and I always had close matches, and of course he had his share of wins too, and so it wasn't one going in with a lot of confidence, but I think my game at this stage was that, you know, I'd got to three legs in, and now I'm going for the fourth leg, which would mean winning the Grand Slam. And so, you know, you see things a little differently, and you know, when you're zeroing in on a court and a competitor, there's not much else out there for me. I'm just looking right ahead, and maybe that's some of the reasons why I probably played some of my best tennis in the important times, was purely because I was focused on, you know, the match itself, and not the long term goal of saying, oh, if I win this, I can win the Grand Slam. That never entered my mind. You know, I went down to Australia just entering each tournament. And as it turned out, I played some of my best tennis along the way. Certainly at the French, when I played, Rose Wall, or Muscles, as I call him, I had to play, my best tennis was to hit out all the time. And so I found myself doing just that. So I played three sets of my best tennis against Rose Wall in 69 at the French. So it was, you know, those sort of things stick out when you're competing and you're going against an opponent. You know, you know that you've been there before, so just take it easy and play.
So, Rod, moving on to the Arthur Ashe semifinal at the U.S. Open, talking about having to keep your focus. I mean, Arthur had played you so tough at Wimbledon, a brilliant first set before you came back to win that. And now here you are against Arthur again, who was the defending champion. What were your thoughts on that match?
You know, Arthur, for some reason, I always felt pretty confident against Arthur. You know, a lot of people had trouble with his serve. And I seem to be able to, I know on the first court, that was the shot that he used to go out wide on my backhand. All I had to think about was, I know that, you know, Arthur didn't have a really good forehand volley or a half volley. And so all I did was, you know, go out there. Well, he went out wide most of the time, and I just angled across court from my backhand into his forehand. He's forehand volleying or half volleying, and that was, I was always in the match when I was playing Arthur, because, you know, he wasn't just going to bomb these big aces past me all the time. And so I felt pretty confident. And I think after you've had some matches where you come through, you know, whether it be Roy Emerson and Dennis Ralston earlier rounds, you've come through some of the tough matches, now you're pretty confident. So it was something that I felt pretty comfortable about being able to play Arthur, and we did have to stop for we stopped for the day, and I think we were in the fourth set, and, you know, came back on the next day, and it was only, you know, the three games, and I had beaten Arthur.
Absolutely. So now, here you are, having beaten Arthur with a string of fine wins over Dennis and Roy and Arthur, and now who should be standing across the net from you for the finals is Tony Roach. But you had some bad weather, as you remember, Rod. The weather was bad after you finished off Arthur, and the final pushed over to Monday, and then a helicopter had to come hover over the stadium court to help dry it because there had been so much rain, and you were delayed about an hour and a half. So how much did all of that weigh on your mind? You're trying to get through the final hurdle and win the Grand Slam, and you've got all these other obstacles, and you've got Roach.
You don't think of all the things that, you know, could go wrong. I think I was always pretty positive, and, you know, when you put a helicopter on top of the grass and you put those blades in there and try to heat it up, I think all we did was brought more water up to the top of the surface rather than drying the top itself. And anyway, that was, you're always caught up on grass courts with all that, those elements. And I think, you know, during the Australian Championships, you know, over those years that we played all the state titles over there, and it was, you know, so you got caught with these conditions. But when I finally looked at the schedule, not the schedule, but the elements, and I had spikes, you know, which are like, they're about 3/8 of an inch in length and a blunt. And so I asked Billy Talbot, the referee at that stage, and I said, if I can't stand up on the court here, can I put spikes on? And they said, "Yeah, this is the last match, so you be my guest. If you need them, you can have them." And so, you know, that's how I went on the court. And I played the first set, and was slipping and sliding, and wasn't very confident. And Tony was the same way; he was sliding too. In the end, I finally said, "I have to change into spikes."
But of course, Rod, you did that. But that was also you lost a very almost a heartbreaking first set when you looked like you were going to win it, and you eventually lost it 9-7. And you never looked discouraged. I mean, was it because you felt you could go to the spikes and get the better footing and lift your game accordingly?
You know, you always hope that you can. But I played with spikes. You know, a lot of players haven't had put spikes on, so they don't realize that there's no skidding. You know, you don't slide to any ball. You run to every shot. And I knew that, and you know, and the court was soft, and of course I was when you're stopping and starting, you know, you're digging the court up, and it wasn't easy to be confident, but at that stage I'd been in with spikes, you know, a lot, so I felt comfortable about progressing along, you know, not trying to do too much of a bottom game with trying to hit winners. It was more keeping the ball low over the net. And if the balls, as we found out, but they didn't bounce very high, so you know that was probably the best thing I could have done, was just to keep the ball low over the net and make Tony dig him out.
And Rod, you were able to sweep those last three sets at the cost of only five games. Did it surprise you that you, after losing a tough first set, that you could turn the match around that convincingly? Because you looked in total control as you won those last three sets and captured the win in four sets.
It was a close match the first set, but as soon as I got into making, you know, all of getting Tony's serve back, controlling the points a little bit by my serve, because I could get to the net fairly quickly and I had good balance, and so I was, you know, I was not having any problem at all in with my volleying or the low shots. Changed the game when I had good footing and Tony didn't have any footing. You know, I looked at him and thinking, yeah, I didn't know if he had spikes or not, and I just said, well, I just got to keep working him through and trying to wrong foot him a lot, and you know, trying to get him keep him off balance. You play the conditions, and that's what, you know, I guess I always realized that. You know, it's no use coming off the court and saying, I wish the court would have been better. I would have played better. You know, you're too late. And so I found myself, you know, going, every post was a winner.
Rod, how gratifying was this one in 69 against all the best players under one tent, second year of open tennis, versus the one in 62 when you were an amateur and you still had to beat a lot of fine players, including Emerson, in three finals, but that wasn't quite, you know, there were some missing players. There were the pro game was absent. The likes of Gonzalez and Rosewell, these guys were not around. So how did you compare 69 to 62? And also, you received a $16,000 check for winning the 69 Open, and I don't think it was the same in 62. Compare the two.
No, you're right. It was a different world back then. And you know, the 69 opposed to 62, I was much more proud of 69, I think, because of all the fact that it was open tennis. And I had against everybody. And, of course, you know, in 62, you know, there was no Hode, no Rosewall, no Gonzalez, you know, none of these players, because they had turned pros the years before. And it was still a, you know, a great effort on my part to come off. And I played Roy Emerson in three of the four finals. It was a thrill to play both. But I think 69 was the most satisfying when I looked back at all of my opponents.
Rod, looking after that 62 triumph, obviously you as you alluded to, you turned pro, so you had those 5 years where you couldn't play the majors, and you were competing and learning a lot by playing against the likes of Hode and Gonzalez in pro tennis. And then you also mentioned that great Wimbledon pro event that you won that really was instrumental in bringing about open tennis. Looking back on it, what do you remember most about that period, and how important was it to you that the open game? How optimistic were you during that period as you played the pro game that we would have open tennis and you would have a chance to be competing in that forum again?
You know, it was a big decision, because when I looked at, you know, all the Hodes and Rosewalls and Trabitz and Trabitz and some of the other players that turned professional, because there wasn't any money in the amateur game at all. And so you've won Wimbledons and the US Opens, and you know, you're looking at your bank account and there's nothing in it. And so I just knew that I had to turn professional. I couldn't afford to play this as an amateur. And so I looked at you know, my whole schedule, and I looked at thinking, I'm never going to be able to play Wimbledon again. I'll never play Wimbledon. I'll never play the Australian. Never play any of these big tournaments again, because I've elected and I've decided to turn pro. And so that was a big decision on my part, to just accept that, you know, things aren't like they were. You know, I've got Hode and Rosewall. I remember playing them down in Australia, and I ended up, I think I played Hode, I think 12 matches, and I lost every one of them. And I played Rosewall, and I think I won two matches out of the 12 or 14 that we played. So, you know, I just knew that there was a lot more for me to understand in the pro game. And I set about understanding and watching them very carefully, what they did. They didn't make mistakes. Their first serve generally always went in the court. They didn't have hit second serves. And if the ball is too pretty tough, don't try and go for a winner when it's not on. Play it more carefully or play it lob. That was where I came from. When I came back into the open ranks, when open tennis, I liked a lot of guys like Roy Anderson and, you know, any of the amateur top players, whether it be Tom Ocker or any of these guys. They said, "But your game has changed so totally." And I found myself pretty proud of the fact that I had been able to then, after 2 years, I was able to beat Hode and Rosewall pretty regularly. And so, you know, when I look at my game, you know, it was totally different. I think Roy Emerson said, "Well, where's that easy little second serve you used to have? You know, how come you've got this big serve now?" And I said, "Well, yeah, is that will probably get beaten every time I turned up." And so, you know, I think I improved my game 100% from when I moved from an amateur into the open ranks.
Now, Rod, I think that would be the prevailing view, and as they all notice. But I'm wondering, you know, you come along. I think of the fact that you were 31 when you won that Grand Slam in 69. So may have been your absolute peak as a player. And then you really played it only a few more times on the grass, and then your U.S. Open career ended up concluding on the clay course, on the Hartrue. And who should you meet in your last match at the Open but Bjorn Borg? Do you remember that occasion, and was that kind of a nice way for you to go out in New York, because Borg was this emerging great player who I think you had so much respect for?
You don't remember all the matches that go on, but, you know, it was an amazing time for me and open tennis. You know, just thinking that amateur tennis, you know, within the 5 years that I was missing, you know, I think they just, hey, this is, we need to change. And the All England Club certainly were the ones that started it. You know, you guys find your best eight players and come in and compete. And so you saw, you know, where it started. And now you've had 5 years of being able to be out and then come back into the game of the open tennis. It was a big challenge, but I think that, you know, when I looked at my game having improved so much, I really didn't have too much trouble with any of the players when I went into the open ranks, having been gone for 5 years.
But do you remember what your impression, not so much the match itself, but just did you have a feeling that when you saw the young Borg, did you think he would be as immensely successful as he was?
Yeah, I think everybody saw him at 17 and being able to, I think at 18 he probably had won the French championships at 18.
Yes, he had.
Maybe even before.
Yeah.
So it was a changing world. The tennis had come of age, and the competition and the prize money structure was starting to get involved. Yeah, yeah, yes, it wasn't very big the first two or three years of open tennis, but it was, you know, I think 16,000 is back from where we were. That was a lot of money.
Absolutely. You were experienced so many, an interesting evolution in the game, getting back onto the grass for those opens in the late 60s into the 70s, and then onto the clay, had that experience on the clay. And then the tournament moved to Flushing Meadows. By that time, you were no longer competing there. But you've seen that the tournament, you saw it grow by leaps and bounds. And did you ever envision that it would be played on that scale, and that the tournament would leave a private club like Forest Hills and get out into Flushing Meadows? How did you feel about that change in location, what it meant to the tournament?
Well, you know, it's just amazing to think amateur tennis has been, they've been trying to get open tennis forever. You know, all the amateur bodies would vote it out. And so here it is, we're finally here. But, you know, when you're looking at, you know, Forest Hills, it was a special place for the amateur world, and you know, all the great champions went through Forest Hills. Yes, it was a private club, and so you knew that something had to give, and I think they just found another location. I never ever played Flushing Meadows, unfortunately, but I, at 31, you know, I'd had a pretty good innings, and I think, you know, yes, I'd won the Grand Slam in 69. I played so much tennis as a youngster from age 17, you know, traveling overseas and having about a 9-month circuit or an 8-month circuit overseas, and then coming back to Australia and playing the all the Australian tournaments, but I never had a break from there until I turned pro, and then all of a sudden I'm playing every night. And so it was one of those, you know, tough situations where, you know, I think I was just exhausted from so much tennis. My wife had also mentioned a few times, you know, do you really need to play all this much tennis? And I thought, you know, I don't need to play this much tennis. And so that was sort of the switch over, and I slowed down.
Well, understandably so, Rod, but you did come back from time to time and saw Flushing Meadows. What were your impressions just as a spectator or visiting the tournament to see this tournament now on the hard courts in this totally different kind of facility and public facility? How impressed yeah. were you with that, with what it had become?
I certainly was just totally impressed with all the amount of, well, the prize money structure, the fact that Flushing Meadows and I got this huge stadium and, you know, plenty of courts to play on and practice. And so the game was expanding. It's hard to put it into words exactly, because I came from, you know, the amateur tennis, from all the amateur courts and the grass courts and clay courts from around the world. But, you know, you don't recognize how big the sport was going to become. That stadium with the Arthur Ashe Stadium that everybody is in love with because of the atmosphere that it brings to the game. I felt good about seeing the game become like this, even though I wasn't going to be a part of it. It was the new breed of young players that are coming through. You know, we've got those composite rackets, you know, and so, you know, it's just such a big explosion of tennis when open tennis hit.
Absolutely. Now, Rod, you did allude to the Arthur Ashe Stadium, and you were there. There was a great parade of champions came out on the court that night for the first night of play in Arthur Ashe mm-hmm. Stadium in 97. What do you recollect about that night? So many great champions came back with you, and you all stood out on the court, and there it was, this brand new majestic stadium. What do you remember about that night? Because you certainly made a point to be there at that ceremony.
I pretty much knew a lot of the older players, you know, whether it be Fred Perry or whether it be Vic Satius, who's, you know, a great player in his time. I do remember one time when I was there, I was with Boris Becker. He just retired, and I think he was 30, and I had to come up to him and I said, "Now, Boris, I'm not understanding why you're retiring at this time and age. Are you exhausted? Are you injuries?" And he said, "No, I'm just exhausted from the amount of tennis I'm playing, and that I got to a young age. I did well at Wimbledon. You just sort of saw those players in their fleeting moments, but they're important moments, because I thought, you know, here's a guy, one of the best players in the game, is retiring at age 30. I think the fact that Stefan Edberg, he retired at age 30 or 31. That's when I played my very best tennis, when I was 30, 31.
But it's interesting you bring that up, Rob, because you've seen now this wave of guys in their mid-30s. You see Federer at 36 going strong, and Nadal still hanging in there at 31. And it seems like it's moving back more to what it was in your day, where guys could play into their mid-30s, because there was that period that you mentioned with Edberg, Becker, Sampras. These guys were all retiring at about 30 or 31, and the prevailing view then was that's when you needed to stop. So what are your thoughts now on so many guys playing great tennis into their mid-30s?
A lot of it is the mere fact that they love the game. They love the competition. You know, yes, they may be not playing as many tournaments as we did when we were a little bit younger. They're enjoying the sport so much more. Now, I look at Nadal and you know, someone like Roger Federer, you know, at 37, he's, you know, in sometimes I look at him and I'm thinking, you know, about 8 or 9 years ago, I'm not sure that you were playing this well. You've got a different backhand, a great volleying ability now. All of a sudden, it seems to me, you're just enjoying every moment that he's on the court, and it's not a chore at all. I think tennis certainly need, you know, the Nadals and Federers and Djokovic's. There's always people going to have injuries. You know, when you look at, you know, someone like the Beckers and Edbergs, they were the big draws around the world, and now they're gone. You know, it's nice that you look at Federer and Nadal and they say, hey, I'm still enjoying the sport, so, you know, why should I give it up? And I think that's sort of a great feather in their caps, that they're also doing so much more for the game.
Well, Rod, it's interesting you mentioned that, because you sat down a few years ago with Federer and his manager, Tony Gottsick, and they came to you and you all created the Laver Cup. And the first one was played last year, enormously successful, great fun for everybody to watch. How gratified are you to have your name attached to that, and where do you think this event can go?
For me, I'm just so honored that my name is on this trophy. And some of the reason, again, is Roger Federer. When he, you know, saw open tennis now 50 years old, before there was plenty of tennis, but no one's going to know about that. He thought that maybe if we had the Laver Cup, I had turned professional, came back into the open ranks, and I had a good record. And he thought, well, let's use you as a way of saying that, you know, there's Don Budd, there's Fred Perry, and there's all these past champions, but no one's going to know about them anymore. And so I think that was how he thought that the Laver Cup could be of a benefit to the history of the game. And I think that was where he came from. And as it turned out, I think, you know, it was a great success. The Laver Cup in Prague was just unbelievably successful. And it was sort of fun for the players themselves. They all said, this is so much fun. And, you know, you've heard of the Ryder Cup in golf, and it's become an established event, hugely successful. And so I don't see any reason why the Laver Cup can't be the same way. You know, you've got six players from Europe and six players from the rest of the world, and they're competing against each other, which generally it's Davis Cup. This way, it's just a whole new breed of players. Each year, if they qualify, they get to compete. This year is going to be in Chicago in September, so I think it'll be fun.
Now, Rod, it what also is going to be fun is this upcoming 50th anniversary U.S. Open, and you talked a lot. You've alluded to Roger Federer a couple of times here now. Last time he won this tournament was 2008. And yet, obviously, he's had won three majors in the last year, a couple of Australians, Wimbledon last year, and it would appear right now that he would be the favorite. How do you look at it? I mean, many months out right now, but would you make him the favorite now to win another U.S. Open in 2018?
Yes, I think if he's in the draw, he's going to be ready to compete. And that to me is you know, the mark of just a great sportsman and a great man with being able to manage himself.
And Rod, finally, looking at the 50th anniversary, and amazing to think that a half a century has passed and you were part of the first U.S. Open, and here we are now celebrating this big occasion. Any final thoughts about how the game has grown by so substantially since your time to what it's become today, and whether and in terms of your own part, are you sorry that you didn't, that maybe open tennis couldn't have come along maybe 5 years sooner and you might have another dozen majors in your collection?
Oh, golly, you know, some other people have asked me that same question, and I don't feel that way. I just was thrilled that open tennis eventually got here. Yeah, everyone knew that if open tennis got here, it'd be successful. It's one of the big things that held tennis back. Who was going to run it? Now you've seen prize money structure has done. You know, I've won a couple of Wimbledons and got a firm handshake and a £10 voucher. I'm not being negative. Just seeing what tennis has done because of the money structure that has come into the game. All the sponsors that are so thrilled about being able to be a big sponsor of these tournaments.
Well, Rod, listen, you've been terrific, and I've enjoyed this very much. Thanks so much for appearing with us on this podcast. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
It is incredible to hear Rod talk about tennis, both in the present tense and, of course, as he did there with Steve Flink, talking about the history, about his own game, and really about how this sport has changed over the last few decades. Now, let's go ahead and check in with Tommy Haas.
First off, just tell me about sort of, you know, this new role for you, your second year here at Indian Wells. What is a challenge that you face every day, but what's also something that you get very excited about being a tournament director at the BNP Paribas Open?
Well, I'm just excited, you know, throughout the whole course of the day, just to be, you know, around the whole action, being around the facility, the players, watching the tennis, getting excited, looking at, you know, as a tournament director now, making sure, hoping that the right players go further, you know, for the fans in some ways. So you're investing your time and energy into those situations. But no, just the you know, all the moving parts, you know, that kind of happen, you know, throughout the day, all the time. You're constantly on your toes, where it's like as a player, you kind of just got ready for your match, and when you play your match and you're done, it's kind of over. But here, it's from the beginning of the day till the late hours of the day, where you're constantly trying to see and work on certain things. But yeah, scheduling is probably one of the most challenging things for throughout the day, where you try to make sure that all the players get what they need, or if you have some kind of requests coming in, that everything goes smoothly and that everybody is respected their choice, and the ATP, WTA, the feed, the world feed, everybody is sort of happy and, you know, kind of, and trying to accommodate that. So but yeah, it's constantly something going on.
Yeah, and for you, I don't think people realize this, but scheduling is, I think people see the schedule and they think it's the easy process, but there's a lot of, what sort of mechanisms are involved in making that decision? Because there's a lot that goes into, say, a schedule for each day at a tournament.
Yeah, for instance, exactly. It's, you know, it's like who's playing the night match the day before. The winner of that match, you know, usually doesn't want to come back too early, but then you have to take in consideration if that player is still in doubles, you have to bring it back a little bit earlier to then have that doubles that later that afternoon. And then it also depends who she is playing in doubles. Has that person played in the singles yet? She might play on a different day due to the big draw that we have here in Indian Wells. So that's permanently a challenge. And you know, you have to say thanks to the ATP and WTA for the people that are in charge of that as well, and the tournament referee that, you know, make sure that you know, that it works out constantly, and they kind of come back here and then present a certain schedule. And, you know, I like to be involved as much as I can and make sure that, again, when I do get some requests, or the ATP WTA gets requests from certain players saying, look, you know, I'm a little bit under the weather, or I haven't slept that good the last couple of nights, you know, I would rather not play first match at 11. So you're constantly trying to see what is going on, and that's kind of like the challenge of making a good schedule.
We've got tennis on the TV here in your office. There's tennis happening all over the grounds. It's been a busy first week. What's now that you're into your second year, was there a big surprise as to this role to you, and I guess what has been the biggest joy for you overall? I mean, obviously I think you have liked sort of changing into this role, but is there one thing that sort of stands out as the best, most exciting part of it?
I don't know. I'm excited as it is, to be honest. This is one of my favorite tournaments, you know, in the world. It used to be as a player, and I was going to be here no matter what for many years to come due to my great relationship with Mr. Ellison. But at the same time, I'm really just enjoying the part of, you know, being behind the scenes as close as I am to really find out and learn all the ins and outs that go into an event. It's truly phenomenal to see all the little aspects and that constantly, you know, that learning part and the behind the scenes sort of thing every day is something I'm very excited about, because there's so much to learn, so much to see, so much to help out with, and, you know, getting new ideas of what we can possibly do better for years to come. Seeing the projects that we have in mind, you know, getting the feedback from the people, the fans that come in, the front box tickets holders that have some ideas or that think they could be better, or, you know, getting the thank yous from many fans coming to the ground saying thank you so much for all that you have done here as tournament director in the last 2 years, where I usually try to say, look, it's a team effort. It's great to be a part of a team after being in an individual sport for so long. So there's so many great aspects of it that I really enjoy. But challenging part again, I think, as a player, where I have a relationship to many players and know exactly where they're coming from and all the hard work and dedication they've put into the sport, you know, choosing the wild cards for them, seeing players taking advantage of the wild cards, saying thank you, writing nice emails, following up on that. I really appreciate that from many players, and the players that might listen to this interview would, you know, a big thank you to them, because it's something that is not expected. So I really feel like, you know, a lot of players have different type of mannerism as well, where you can kind of see, you know, who does what, and that's also great to see and eye opening. And so there's, like I said, you know, I can go on and on, but there's constantly something that is very challenging, exciting at the same time, but I'm just happy to be part of it.
Do you think that the player, I mean, I would say probably there's a different level of players' understanding or comprehension of all the things that go into a major event like this, because you're talking about, you know, box office and ticket holders and around the grounds, and I think as a player, as you would well know, players are mostly just focused on playing tennis.
Absolutely, and that's what they should be mostly focused on, is to make sure that they get their rest, that they eat healthy, that they're prepared, and that they do well, and that's all that we want in the end. But you know, for us as an event, you know, you look at, okay, how many tickets have we sold, you know, how many suites are still available for this year, or did all the people, are they getting what they want? I mean, you know, from the outside point of view, and then you kind of look at it from my point of view, is like, okay, are we taking care of this, are we taking care of that? Now let's see what the players are doing, how are they performing, how are they going out there, so the players, that the fans get what they deserve to watch good tennis. So again, there's always the moving parts, again, that is so good to be a part of and to really see it, and it's eye-opening for me, and I think every player at some point should maybe have the opportunity to maybe go behind the scenes for just 3-4 days, just to see really what it's like, you know, get there very early morning and leave very late at night and sort of be a part of this whole experience, because I think they would understand and maybe respect it a little bit more as well.
Tommy, I don't know if I should use the R word, retirement, with you. tell us about your tennis right now. Where is it? I know that you've signed up to play some Champions events this year with Jim Courier and his tour, but I know that you still get out there, including here in Indian Wells and also elsewhere, but where are you with your tennis?
Yeah, I try to get out there as much as I can. Haven't been able to get out there too much this week. Hopefully, maybe by the end of this week, I have an excuse, because matches are becoming less and less. But yeah, you know, I obviously am very passionate about tennis. It's the greatest workout for me. I just still enjoy hitting that yellow fuzzy little tennis ball. You know, sometimes it leaves a little bit of anger out, and you get the joy from it. You sweat, you move your body, which is very important, and you forget about doing that when you are in the office from early morning to late at night. And then if you don't do your workouts in the morning, you know, usually late at night, you just don't have the energy anymore. But yeah, I'm very excited to be a part of the Champions Tour of Jim Courier's tour, Inside and Out, who's promoting it. It's exciting, you know. I feel like I'm at the right age to sort of join the tour. I feel like I'm playing a lot of guys that are much younger than I am, with you know, James Blake and Andy Roddick, and but it'd be exciting to still go out there, possibly play against the likes of Jim Courier and John McEnroe, possibly, and many others. Hopefully Agassi will come and play a couple and
Michael
stuff
Chang.
Like that. Michael Chang, exactly. So really just excited to see you know, familiar faces and go out there and try to tease each other a little bit, and, you know, give some of the fans that are coming out to watch us a good show, hopefully. And that's exciting and gives me an excuse to try to stay in some kind of a shape. And again, I was gonna hit tennis balls no matter what anyway. I do with most of my friends or people that are even just excited to go out there. If I get an email sometimes saying, hey, would you, you know, mind playing with me, you know, I try to usually do that as much as I can. So just, yeah, so that'll keep me busy enough.
Yeah, so we're celebrating 50 years of open era tennis this year, including at the U.S. Open. German tennis is, I mean, you know, you look at back at what Steffi and Boris were able to do, and I think what you and Nicholas Kiefer sort of tried to continue on, and right. Then you look at this new era of German tennis. I guess just overall, how do you see Germany fitting into what open era tennis is, and how, you know, now as you sort of reflect on what you were able to do in your career as well?
Yeah, you know, for me, obviously, you know, Boris Becker and Steffi Graf were my idols, especially Boris. You know, I remember him winning Wimbledon back in 1985, and I knew right there and then, I was in tennis already a few years, but I knew right there and then that this is what I wanted to become as a professional tennis player. I remember getting up, you know, early mornings to watch, you know, the US Open late night matches. I remember that really, really well, that I was always allowed to do that. You know, my parents, my father especially, let me do that, you know, watching Boris play. Steffi and Boris, you know, have done had great success at the US Open as well, especially Steffi. I'm not exactly sure how many times she won, but I would say at least 4 or 5 times. And, you know, Boris did the same and I think became number one the 1 year as well. I remember when playing Derek Wastanio when he saved match point in the third round to go continue on to win the US Open. Always just really special. You know, it wasn't easy, I think, for the young generation to see or try to follow the footsteps of these great German players that we had, including Michael Stieg. Yes. Who was a very successful player as well, you know, pretty much winning everything that is to win out there. So, you know, for me, that was never really the pressure part. You know, I always just wanted to become a professional tennis player. And if somebody did compare me with maybe being the next Boris Becker, I always took it as a compliment. And I thought maybe people believe in me. And mostly I believed in myself, knowing that that's where I was going to go and nothing is going to stop me. And having great memories myself, you know, actually my first US Open that I played, I qualified in 1996 and I got to play Michael Stieg on the old grandstand court.
Did you?
So that's like one of my favorite memories in that way. And, you know, in that sense, looking back, you know, playing a German icon in that sense and, you know, actually playing a pretty good match and losing, unfortunately, in four. But that was my first US Open experience.
I like how you're pretty sharp with memories overall. I like that. I guess that was kind of my last question, was just US Open memories. You know, make your debut in 96. I think you made the quarterfinals, at least 3 times.
Right.
Had a lot of great runs there. But what's special for players? Because I think as media and, you know, fans, we know the U.S. Open as this electric sort of New York place. But why do players sort of tend to like that event so much as well?
Oh, well, first of all, you're in New York City. It's always nice to have an excuse to go to New York. You know, great restaurants, you know, great shopping, just walking around, especially for Europeans, has a little bit of that European feel where you can just, you know, go out to your hotel room and just walk around to coffee shops or great restaurants, go a little shopping. You know, the family usually likes being in New York. It's electrifying, the electricity in the town. You always know you're in New York. You know, you can hear the sirens going by at 3 in the morning if you don't have if you're too low on the grounds in the hotel or not one that has, you know, strong enough or thick enough windows, so you always look at that as well, depending on where you're staying. But you know, once you hit the site, you know, you see the massive stadium, you know, Arthur Ashe Stadium, you know, Billie Jean King Tennis, USA Tennis Center. It's just massive, you know, and you look at how it's developed over the years. Again, the history on Louis Armstrong Court, when I first played there, there was no Arthur Ashe Stadium even there yet in 96, and then I saw it developing and being part of that. So I guess, you know, just being part of, you know, the growth of the tournament in general for so many years, you know, seeing my idols play there, you know, seeing the night matches with Sampras, Agassi, then being a part of it myself, playing night matches against people like Sampras, the year he actually won it in 2002, his last major. Mm-hmm. So being part of sort of like some of that history as well, you know, playing my own night matches late at night, you know, up until, you know, 12:30, 1 in the morning, and still seeing some fans, you know, hanging out and cheering you on. That's what makes the US Open, I think, so very special. You know, the airplanes flying over, you know, it's like
all of it.
All of it. You just have to really be mentally tough because it is a grind. You know, you have to try to block everything else out and try to get your rest when you can, because there's more distractions than other events. And you know, the drive into Queens sometimes to the event can be quite tough as well, because it's a, you know, just a lot of traffic sometimes. And they close the roads, the Midtown Tunnel is not open. It's like, you know, you just kind of go crazy if you don't have the patience, which I wasn't always known for. But still, I've played tremendous tennis there. I've had some really, really good results. A lot of five-set matches. You know, one set sticks out is against James Blake and Marat Safin, you know, 7-6 in the fifth. I do like the fact they play a tiebreak in the fifth set and not go on and on and on. I love it. I think every slam should have it, in my opinion. If you're out there for 4 hours, 3 hours, and you both won two sets and you held your serve six times, why continue and why beat yourself up and not be able to maybe come back the next time? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you're putting a tiebreak on a big match who goes into the third or fourth round, I think that to me makes much more sense. And I like that. And I like that about the US Open, that they have that.
Yeah, awesome. Well, best of luck here.
Thank
you.
In
the last few days. A little different out here in the desert, but you guys have a great event. Congrats. Thanks.
This has been episode 5 of Courtside, the official podcast from the US Open. You can find us everywhere, essentially, now. We're on Spotify, we're on iHeartRadio, you also can find us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to the team at the USTA for putting this together, and another thanks to my partner in podcast crime, that is the Hall of Famer himself, Steve Flink. One more thanks to Tommy Haas, as well as to Rod Laver for spending some time with us. We appreciate you taking the time to listen, and we'll talk to you again soon.